I'd like to go ahead and begin our webinar this morning by introducing our first speaker. Dr. Dan Sumner is the Frank Buck Jr. Professor in the Department of Agriculture and Resource Economics at the University of California, Davis, and the Director of the University of California Agriculture Issues Center. He is also the Academic Director of the California Agribusiness Seminar. Dan participates in research, teaching, and directs an outreach program related to public issues facing agriculture. He's published broadly in academic journals, books, and industry outlets. His award-winning research and writing focuses particularly on the economics of agriculture and food and agricultural policy. Prior to returning to California a couple decades ago, Dan was the Assistant Secretary for Economics at the United States Department of Agriculture. In his role as Supervisor of Agriculture's Economics and Statistics Agency, he was responsible for USDA's data collection, outlook, and economic research. From 1978 to 1992, Dan was a professor in the Division of Economics and Business at North Carolina State University, and between 87 and 88, he was a senior economist at the President's Council of Economic Advisors. Dan was raised on a fruit farm in Susan Valley, California, and was active in 4-H and FFA activities as a youth. He received bachelor's degrees in agricultural management from California Polytechnic State University in San Luis Obispo, a master's degree from Michigan State, and a PhD in economics from the University of Chicago. Dan, it gives me great pleasure to welcome you to today's program. We very much appreciate your taking time from your busy schedule to be with us, so without further delay, please go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you very much. I realize when I've been doing this for so long, the introduction takes about half my time. I think I'm going to have to leave some things out. But I have been doing this sort of thing for a long time, and I didn't count the number of farm bills I've paid close attention to over the years. But it probably starts with the 81 farm bill, so somebody else can count them up for me. So I tend to look at these things, I suppose, and say, gee, not that much has really changed from one to the next. So my subtitle there, Business as Usual, really refers to taking a fairly broad look at the whole package of the farm bill, including risk management. Now, that's not to say, and I wouldn't want to be quoted as saying, that there aren't lots of changes in what we might refer to as important details for any given farm or ranch or business operation. So there are lots of things that people want to pay close attention to. There may be new business opportunities created by this farm bill, and there may be new regulations or other things people want to watch for. But we are talking about hundreds of pages, and if you include the manager's report and the other things coming out of it, thousands of pages, and the regulations will be more than that. So there's plenty to pay attention to here. Obviously, that means I'll hit a few highlights. Fortunately for my presentation this morning, Elbert Collard, a few weeks ago, she's from Mississippi State, a few weeks ago she did a very careful and detailed look at the major provisions of the Farm Bill, all the way from in every title, all 12 titles, looking for things that might affect specialty crops and fruits and vegetables, trees and vines. And so I don't need to repeat all of that. I'm going to focus on risk management particularly, and not so much tell you on which page of the Farm Bill you want to find these things, but talk a little more about interpretation or what they mean. I also want to refer you to some work and presentations made by my colleague Mickey Paggy, who's down at Fresno State University. Mickey's presentations aren't online here with the Ag and Uncertain Times website, but they are available for him, and I'm sure he'd be willing to make those available. He's been making presentations around the country on specialty crops in the Farm Bill. Finally, Hinok Lee, who I work with closely here at UC Davis, has a research program focusing on specialty crops and risk management, and also supply response to specialty crop risk management subsidies. So she's the other person I would refer people to. She's in the Department of Agricultural Economics, Agriculture and Resource Economics here at UC Davis. So let me see if I can move to the next slide, and that did work. I focus on trees and vines, but it's really specialty crops or fruits and vegetables more broadly that I'll be talking about. The crop insurance benefits are continuing in the Farm Bill. There are some changes, and I'm going to highlight those. They make a substantial transfer of farm risk to taxpayers. And then the question is, what does that do? Not just transferring risk to taxpayers or transferring dollars away from taxpayers and towards producers of certain sorts, but what does it do? And there, what one expects, and certainly what's driving at least a public policy rationale for these sort of programs, is that they, as crop insurance expands to more crops and grows faster in regions with marginal production, that's going to have some effects on who grows what, where, and when. And I want to emphasize that that's not all to the positive for every grower. If you're growing strawberries in Montana in April, crop insurance may look like a great idea. If you're the competitor growing strawberries in the Salinas Valley in April, you may be not so happy that the federal government has decided to subsidize strawberry production among your competitors. And I mention that one because there's not a lot of gain to those from crop insurance for strawberries in a place where they're very well suited and the risks are relatively small. And in fact, we currently don't insure crop insurance for strawberries, but as we'll see in a moment, this Farm Bill is pushing in that direction. And in fact, part of that push is to increase expenditures for crop insurance. This is mostly for the standard field crops, but includes the specialty crops, adding about $6 billion over 10 years. That's about $90 billion overall over 10 years, so you can see the $6 billion increase is a substantial increase of 7 or 8%. That's at a time when many of the farm program subsidies are expected to cost less over the decade. These things are authorized, they're not, and they're mandatory funding, so it's not an appropriated dollar. It's projections that economists and others have done, trying to guess what programs will cost over the decade. Crop insurance goes back a long time, even for specialty crops. The point is not inventing the process. So when I say crop insurance here, I'm talking about government-subsidized programs that are now run out of the risk management agency, even though they're offered by private companies. So I'm talking about the federal backing for crop insurance. And it's not an absolute, but it's a pretty broad rule of thumb that if the federal government, or for that matter any other government around the world, doesn't provide substantial subsidy for crop insurance programs, they don't exist. That is to say, this is a market that the private sector does not generate, and it's a little beyond our scope here this morning to ask why that is, but it is a general principle really everywhere around the world. If governments don't subsidize crop insurance, there's not enough interest on the part of growers, or you could say there are other market failures to suggest why that these programs simply don't exist. By 2011, we're covering most of the perennial crops, the fruit and nut crops, including the vine crops, and a lot of vegetables, including dry beans and peas, and then some of the fresh market vegetables. But a lot of the produce items are, in fact, not covered. So I mentioned strawberries, but that's also true for a number of other produce items. There is pressure on the risk management agency, and we'll talk about that, to broaden the scope, and that's a big deal going forward, something we all want to pay attention to. So liabilities in 2011 were about $12 billion. That was about 10% of total crop insurance liabilities. So specialty crops in total are still only about 10% of all the liabilities. Whereas for the field crops, revenue insurance has been growing rapidly. For the specialty crops, for fruits and vegetables and trees and vines, yield insurance is still, that's APH, is the yield insurance, actual production history, is still the most widely used, except for nursery crops where the concept of a yield is a little hard to measure, and those folks are in a dollar sort of a plan. Catastrophic insurance is available for a number of crops. That really is catastrophic, 50% of yield, 55% of a USDA announced price. So you really have to be wiped out pretty substantially before that kicks in. That insurance, again, is essentially free. There's a little sign-up fee. But for a grower of any substantial size, that coverage is essentially free where it's available. But it doesn't do much good. You know, it'll pay off. It may be worth signing up for, but most growers would never expect to get anything out of that one. What they call buy-up gets you coverage up to 85% of production in an acre, up to 100% of a USDA RMA price for the item, and price selection we're going to talk about in a few minutes is difficult to figure out. Those market prices are specified by crop, by region, with as much specificity as they can to make it make sense for growers. And those of you that are familiar with the specialty crop industries, fruits and vegetables, know there's immense variation from crop to crop, from location to location, fresh and produce. And when we start talking about wine grapes, we may have 10 and 20 times price differences between, say, Thompson seedless grapes used for wine in the Central Valley of California and Cabernet Sauvignon grown out of Napa, producing the kind of wine that only John can afford to buy. So this has been around for a while, and the question is what has the farm bill done to it? Notice premium subsidies are up to about 62%. That's only a part of the subsidy because the program also pays for most of the administration and operation costs for the insurance companies. Some of that money is then returned in the form of lower premiums. And also taxpayers cover reinsurance for those insurance companies. So again, some of that shows up in lower premiums. So the 62% subsidy is the lower bound, and we're probably talking more in the range of 80 or 90% relative to some sort of conceptual fair market premium without the government involved if such a program were offered. I have a California illustration here. California produces a significant part of the fruits and vegetables in the country, 30, 40, 50% depending on what you're talking about, and for a lot of items is the only supplier. We have reasonable data here. So the thousands of acres and millions of dollars are both on our scale here. So it's about total buy-up liability is in the range of $3.5 billion, and cat liability is about $1.5 billion. Acreage is about 2 million acres of each. That gives you a notion. There's been very rapid growth, especially in buy-up liability. The acreage has been covered, hadn't changed a lot, given the CAT program was instituted after 1995, but and notice CAT acreage has actually come down, but buy-up is what's expanded, buy-up meaning going up to 85% of liability. And what's the distribution of crops here in California? Mostly trees and vines. About 65% or so is perennials. Field crops out here is only about 20% of the liabilities. Vegetables are another 10%. And the vegetables are more processing tomatoes than anything else. So that gives you a flavor of at least one place where specialty crops and trees and vines are important. They are a big part of the insured crops. Coming back to the U.S. as a whole, we see about half of perennial crops are about half of the total specialty crop insured liability. So that's fruits and nuts are the dark blue. Nursery crops are a substantial part of liability. They're a little bit special in the sense that they're for the most part not field planted, and so they're not on a yield basis, but on a dollar plan, as we'd mentioned earlier. So what's this farm bill do? What are the changes in crop insurance policy that are specific to specialty crops? So I'm not going to talk about the Stacks program for cotton, et cetera, et cetera. Those can be important for specialty crops, but I'm not going to focus on them this morning with one small exception. The first thing is it allows RMA to conduct research and development for trying to improve tools for underserved crops, and most of those tend to be specialty crops in underserved regions. So when I said strawberries in Montana in April, that's certainly underserved. I don't know if probably there's a greenhouse somewhere where somebody's trying to do it. And if RMA was pushed hard enough, they may well try to develop a program for that crop. But there's lots of pressure from Congress to spread crop insurance just as widely as they can into crops that aren't now covered in regions, even if the crop is covered, to move it to regions that aren't covered for that crop. And that's done on a county-by-county basis. And this relates a bit to our next talk. There's a study looking for the feasibility of insuring specialty crops for producers of for losses associated with food safety or contamination. So periodically, we get an outbreak or the threat related to something. For example, FDA might find a few years ago they thought there was something in tomatoes. A month later, they said, whoops, that turned out to be peppers, or that turned out to be cilantro or some other contaminant. Well, meanwhile, the fresh market tomato guys had lost several hundred million dollars in sales and price collapse, and what was available to them was from FDA and the Center for Disease Controls. Those losses are currently not insurable under normal crop insurance programs. The big issue out here in California, and it has been, is what about the drought? Many of you know the sort of droughts we have here is it doesn't rain or it doesn't snow in the mountains, and that affects a vegetable grower a thousand miles away. And so it's not, I didn't get rain on my field, and so my yields aren't good. It didn't snow in the mountains last winter. Therefore, somebody in the federal or state governments decided they weren't going to deliver water to my ranch. Therefore, I have to use a lot less irrigation. My yields aren't good. Now, is that an insurable loss? Maybe, maybe not. People don't really know yet. And that's, in that sense, the crop insurance program has added a lot to the uncertainty as growers go into this drought season, not quite understanding what's insured, what isn't, what sort of losses are covered, what sort of losses aren't. And what sort of mitigation would growers have been expected to do to avoid some sort of administrative water cutoff? Those are really important issues, and may become even more important as we go forward. So what exactly is covered is something that the Risk Management Agency is making progress on, but progress is hard. I want to mention crop insurance for organics. There are lots of trees and vines and other specialty crops in the organic business. It's not just those. There's plenty of organic wheat and corn out there. But a big chunk of organics are the specialty crops. And one of the questions is this even possible? When you have prices that are very specific to local areas, to particular markets, where the markets are really quite thin and they're based on contracts, say from a retailer directly to a grower, how does the Risk Management Agency, together with, say, USDA marketing agencies, get data that's applicable to organic specialty crops in order to avoid moral hazard or even adverse selection that would make the premiums for those crops not feasible? So currently, organic growers have been eligible like everybody else, but the price selections they've had have been the conventional crops. Well, if your organic crop typically sells for double the conventional and you can only insure the conventional price, that's really cold comfort. On the other hand, if it's almost impossible to get the organic price in an objective sort of a way, then it becomes prohibitively or almost prohibitively expensive. And so far, it has been in a sense prohibitive in the sense that nobody's really done it in any sort of widespread scale. The Risk Management Agency now has the mandate to do it. Is it possible? Well, I guess if somebody tells you you have to do something, that makes it possible. We'll see what happens. I think the bottom line is it's really hard, and we'll see how well they can get that done. It's a part of their overall mandate to expand the number and a variety of crops, including for organic crops. The other issue we should raise here for the Risk Management Agency, to give them a little sympathy here, is that there's also substantial scale economies here. So when those of us out here in California, for example, say, gee, most of the coverage is for field crops, if you're covering, 70 million acres of soybeans, there's a certain scale economy relative to covering maybe 30 million acres or 30,000 acres of strawberries. And that's a real challenge for the agency. Let me go through an example, if I can, just for a few minutes. Monterey, California is the biggest specialty crop produce, fruit and vegetable crop county in the country, about $4.2 billion worth of agricultural production, more than most states in the United States. About 80% of that is fresh produce, most of it not now covered by crop insurance. Most of that happens down on the Salinas Valley floor, though there are wine grapes up in the hills and a few things like that. Here's the set of crops, the top five. Fruit is 26% of the value of production in this county. Vegetables are about 65%. There's some cattle up in the hills, that's the other. Leaf lettuce, head lettuce, broccoli, some nursery crops. Wine grapes are there with a little over $200 million worth. So that gives you a flavor of what agriculture looks like in this place. And very important to when you think about the risks, these are earthquake fault lines. Those of you that are familiar with this country, this is going north to south. What's on the west there is the Pacific Ocean. The one running right down through the middle of the county is Highway 101. Along the edges, Highway 1, and those are the arteries that bring things together. Salinas is up towards the north, which is where they clean and pack a lot of vegetables. Through the center of that county is a very productive vegetable and even wine grape growing region. Well, what happens if there's an earthquake that disrupts 101 or disrupts in terms of transportation, disrupts electricity at a packing plant, so that cooling can't be done? Immediate post-harvest losses on the day that happens. If there's an earthquake around Salinas, they get the hospitals up first. They take care of families and other factories. The vegetable cooling facility is not top of the list. Imagine that is out for a week. Annual harvest hasn't gone down that much. You don't meet 85% of your total loss, say, if you're thinking about an annual crop. But there are substantial losses because Roberta Cook always reminds me that in the produce business, it's either sell it or smell it. And so there are substantial losses here. And it matters when it happens. 95% of the leaf lettuce in the country comes from Salinas in July. None of it comes from Salinas in December. It's moved off to other parts of Arizona, Florida, and other places during that time of the year. 83% of the nation's strawberries, this is fresh market strawberries, are coming out of Salinas in August. 86% of the head lettuce then. So these are seasons when national supplies can be disrupted. If something happens for a week, we will all notice in the supermarket, and the growers will certainly notice. Well, what does that mean economically? Actually, if it happens in the peak season, prices go up. If you're hit, you're wiped out. Prices going up doesn't help you. If you're outside the area that's hit, if your packing plant still has electricity, you're making extra profits during that season. So it turns out, how do you insure a crop like this? What do you do to get it to make sure that you can cover losses? I don't think it's crop insurance, frankly. I think it might be business losses. It might be something else. There may be some liability from your through your packing plant insurance. But these are substantial economic losses that it's just not clear what the risk management agency is going to do about it or can do about it, or we as policy analysts really want them to try to do about it. That is, it's not even clear what sort of adaptation to disruption you'd expect from growers here in dealing with moral hazard or even risk aversion in this context. So here are the kind of here's a table of some losses. I'm not going to go through all these numbers, but the revenue losses for growers that are hit in the Salinas Valley, revenue gains from growers that aren't hit from other producers, net revenue gains or losses depending on when it happens. Does it happen in June? For leaf lettuce, you get a gain. For strawberries, you get a gain on net. But if it doesn't happen in the peak season, you may well have a loss in total. So that is to say, when you think about insuring these crops, what do you do if you lose? The taxpayer covers it. If you gain, of course, you keep the revenue. It's very hard to figure out exactly how you're going to provide insurance for these kind of crops and these kind of losses, but the risk management agencies have been told to push just as far as they can in the direction of covering risky agriculture, and that's why I wanted to highlight a risk that a lot of people don't think about around the country. So what are the broader lessons and economic considerations? I would say the whole point of expanding crop insurance availability is improve the competitive position, allowing expansion of crops where they do not now grow at times of year where they do not now grow. And the commercial impacts of that raise really interesting issues for size and location of industries. Frankly, if all we were doing with crop insurance was providing additional revenue with nothing changes, why are we doing it? That is to say, if it's not helping growers find new crops they can grow where they're now too risky, if it's just a matter of subsidizing people to do exactly what they're doing now, it's a puzzle what the public policy is there. So in fact, changing supply patterns, I would argue, is a part of the objective here. It's saying to growers who may look at a crop that would otherwise be profitable if there was insurance and say to them, we'll cover some of your risks so that you can find a new crop that is newly profitable where you're going. We do that with really very large subsidies, 80% or so subsidies, and there is a question about the public policy purpose. If we could do it without these large subsidies, that may be preferable, but we know from practice the growers don't sign up in that case, which means the only growers that are there are the ones that have a particularly high risk profiles. This is a parallel to government-sponsored health insurance, where if you don't subsidize it, only the sick people sign up. If you don't subsidize the insurance, in this case, only the people with very high risk profiles sign up, which makes it not feasible. So that's the real challenge. And that's the economic lessons here. And I want to emphasize, major reasons that are currently growing perennial crops where supply elasticities are fairly inelastic, that is, farmers don't respond a lot to price in the short run because they can only respond to price in planting new trees and vines that are going to come online in a few years or more at the other end by yanking trees and vines. In those cases, encouraging production in regions that by nature are a little less suitable really puts economic pressure on the areas where they're centrally located. That's one reason we don't currently have crop insurance for a number of the produce items. The produce industry has said, no, thank you, we oppose crop insurance for our crops. It may seem ironic, but you have a major farm organization saying, no, thank you, we don't want subsidies. And the reason is not just they have some sort of philosophical point to make. They look at this and say, we're not going to get much out of it, and it will end up being a subsidy to the people that are not now in the industry, and to the advantage of the people that are currently in the industry. And that's a challenge in thinking through these kind of programs. So final remarks, and that says markets, because I've been talking about markets. So you can think of this as final remarks if you want, or at some point we'll fix that typo. Risk management continues its heightened role as security, and it remains high on the agenda. That is to say, the risk management agency, and for that matter other parts of USDA, are told in very clear terms in this farm bill, find ways to take risk out of farming. Those of you that also look at dairy programs, we're actually ensuring net revenue in that case. We haven't done that with crop insurance for specialty crops, but one could imagine developing programs that say, gee, farm labor is the riskiest thing you have. We'll insure you against farm labor disruptions. We'll insure you against the difference between your labor bill and your revenue. There are a number of sort of programs one can imagine the government wanting to sponsor here that might be quite popular with growers, very hard to administer. From a broader perspective, food stamps still get the big bucks. 80% of the farm bill expenditures are in food grant. The same handful of commodities, field crops, get the bulk of the subsidies. Or through trade barriers, small commodities like sugar still get substantial subsidies. I mentioned dairy a minute ago. We have a new risk management program for dairy. There's still relatively little attention to R&D and things that would generate innovation and productivity growth for U.S. agriculture. That's really not what the Farm Bill is about, and that's business as usual. Where I come from, and especially crops in particular, look at the Environmental Protection Agency, immigration issues, international trade, tax law, financial regulation. All of those are headlines in their eyes. What happens in the Farm Bill, frankly, isn't the main farm law. And not only that, state and local regulations and laws end up being more important than federal regulation laws for many specialty crop growers. Maybe that's as it should be. There's a lot in the Farm Bill they need to pay attention to, but it is not the most important thing for many of these growers. And I think that's the end of my presentation, and we're open for discussion. I've got a few minutes, and then I'm going to run teach a class.
Well, Dan, thank you very much for that great overview of the Farm Bill and its implications for specialty crop growers. We do have several questions that have come in from participants, and I'd like to put a couple of those to you, but as I understand, and you mentioned, you've got a teaching obligation, so let me get through those as quickly as we can here. The first question asks, what challenges might RMA face in developing crop insurance for these various organic crops?
Right, and I highlighted those in the presentation itself, and that may cover it, but the biggest thing is the price election issue. It's just, I mean, we know there's very specific risk profiles. We may be able to get some data to handle that. Growers that have a five-year production history, we can certainly go with that, as long as they haven't changed their technology much. But the real issue is on the price side, and can we get publicly available data? We meaning really not we, but can RMA get publicly available price data that's representative enough that applies to individual growers so that the insurance is viable for them? And that is a hard challenge. They've been working on it for a long time. They've now been told to do it better. Anybody that's got good ideas, I'm sure they're happy to hear it.
Right. So to follow that up, the next question asks, regarding these prices and the mandate to expand the price list, what might we expect from RMA regarding when that longer list might be available or how many crops it might reasonably cover when it is expanded?
Yeah. Boy, oh boy, you know, if you define a crop, you know, from their point of view, a policy, if you say organic red leaf lettuce in Salinas Valley and organic carrots in Fresno County, those are the kind of crop selections we're talking about here. There are literally hundreds and hundreds of these potentials, all of which take some effort. If you get it wrong, there's potential for very significant losses. So they really have a challenge. The question was when. I don't see it happening in the short run. They're swamped trying to get the Stacks program up and running and lots of other things by 2015. So I don't see this in the short run. RMA, as they will tell you, are understaffed for these sort of things. They are outsourcing to private companies and academics and other consultants, but they have some real challenges there. I think they have the life of this farm bill to try to comply with what Congress told them to do. I don't remember a specific date where they had to meet a specific target for the number of organic crops that they get covered with new price selections. I don't see it happening in the very short run. I wouldn't think in the next year, and maybe not in the next two or three, will they cover many more new crops and regions.
Oh, great. Thanks for that answer, because that really does clarify for me a bit. And so to kind of follow that even further, the third question, I guess the last one I've let you go here, is given your long-term perspective on farm policy, do you expect continued broadening of insurance options for growers of these various specialty crops and whatnot into the future?
Yeah, you know, at some point you'd think, you know, it's easy for Congress to tell administrators to do things. Congress isn't necessarily tethered in reality. And to the extent that they can say, hey, do this, and there's always some demand back home from they are tethered in political reality, and there are interests back home saying, hey, we don't have organic blueberries covered in this part of Vermont. Why don't you make sure RMA does their job? You know, there's always those requests coming into Congress, and so it's hard to see it stopping on a political basis. But I do think it's at some point administrators at USDA, at the Risk Management Agency or other places, really will say enough is enough, and there's no way that one can make these cost-effective even at the 80% loss ratios. That is to say, we just don't know enough to be able to do this in any kind of a reasonable way. And I don't know how much pushback the agency can do. It is Congress. Congress does write, does control the purse strings on these things too. So until Congress is willing to come back at the appropriations level and says, here's hundreds of millions of dollars or more money to have massive amounts of underwriting agents and other things involved in this process, there is a natural limit where you just can't go much further. Some people thought they'd already hit that 5 years ago. They've now been told for another 5 years to push further, but it does hit some sort of diminishing returns here pretty darn quickly. I should probably stop there. The last thing I'll say is we've been talking about crop insurance and risk management for specialty crops. It matters what happens to other crops. I noticed somebody had asked about alfalfa. The risk management, and there are 80 million acres of alfalfa and other hays out there that don't have crop insurance, and the Risk Management Agency has said, what about those? Here in the Central Valley of California, alfalfa is grown on the same land that might otherwise go to almonds or pistachios, and if alfalfa is covered for crop insurance, that makes it more attractive, which makes land in especially irrigation water harder to come by for some of the specialty crops. So crop insurance interacts across crops, not just across regions, and it's a real interesting phenomenon for economists and growers and others to keep an eye on as implementation of this farm bill continues. Thanks a lot, John.
Well,
I better run off to class.
Very much appreciate your being with us, so thanks again.